How did that hit you when you realized that? It was a sickening feeling for me. And not only that, but any other time there's been terrorism or violence or similar situations, I know we're getting accustomed to it, but terrorism is very real, isn't it? Why did those people jump? Different reporters reported different things, but the underlining reason seemed to be that they felt like, well, there's no hope in here, and they took their lives. A world without hope. What would it be like if a world kept continuing from one tragedy to another, to another, to, should we put this one up on the screen? We've all been through this. The whole news reels of everything the last 2.5 or more years. Disease hitting our country, or maybe the way we responded to that disease maybe shocked us in some ways. Maybe how others responded to us and we responded to them. Is this what will end our world? Things like this? And what about as this one began to flash all over the news? It keeps getting our attention. Some say, well, it's propaganda. They're trying to keep us focused on that so we won't focus on other things. But nonetheless, wars keep happening, don't they? Disease keeps happening. Terrorism keeps happening. Shootings keep happening. And a lot of people are wondering, where can I turn to for hope? I've been in situations in my life where I didn't have a source to turn to. And I can tell you, as I look back on those experiences, it doesn't feel very good. It doesn't feel, fear itself feels terrible, doesn't it? Where do we turn to for hope? How will everything all end up? We kind of want to know this, don't we? Is this going to be more of the same old, and keep going on? And wouldn't that be somewhat like hell on earth if it kept going the way it's going? Not a very hopeful picture. And so my experience, and you've responded to a flyer or an invitation or Facebook thing popped up on your phone, you're here for a reason. And our main reason here is to consider a source of hope, a source that I have found that's been helpful in my life, and not just the Bible in general, but in particular a book that for quite a while in my younger days I was quite frankly afraid of. Younger days, you're like, he's only in his 40s. Teenager, right around the corner here in Douglas County, all kinds of UFO stories on our ranch area and other stuff. So I get it. I have had other sources in my life, but as I look for hope and I look for something that is consistent, that makes sense, that I can put together and I can share with others, I find no other source like the Bible. And so if you've come for this Revelation seminar, we've talked about it being a chapter-by-chapter study. It's impossible in four going on 5 weekends really to give you every single verse of every single chapter. I've taken like a year of Revelation classes, and frankly, each one, each teacher was a little different. He had to put it all together, and to do for semesters what we're going to do in just a few weekends will be almost impossible to get you through every single verse. So I'm going to try to give you highlights from each chapter as we go through this book. As you look in your binder, you see that tonight we're in chapter 1. In fact, we're starting in the first verse. The revelation of Jesus Christ. There's a whole bunch of loaded words behind that expression. The revelation of Jesus Christ. It's a revealing of Jesus Christ. It's not just songs about Jesus. It's not just words about Jesus. This whole book, the symbols and the imagery, we're supposed to reveal something. We're supposed to reveal someone. That's why that flyer has a picture of Jesus on the front of it. I've used the Beastly flyers, I've used Armageddon flyers, I've used all kinds of flyers, but as I look at the book of Revelation carefully, the beasts are in the background, they are there, they are very real, they are, the Antichrist is very, all these different things are very real, but what's paramount, if you look at that, especially that little insert that you have there, is Jesus, a revealing of Jesus. And not only that, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to Jesus, who gave to his servants, that's John, which we'll talk more about tomorrow night, things which must shortly take place. Things which must shortly take place. Things. That's pretty vague, isn't it? I don't know about you, but as I read a phrase like that, I think, what are you talking about, things that are soon to take place? And maybe you haven't taken Greek or done word studies on the Bible, but there are the original languages behind each one of these different words that we find here. Things is the same thing. What about how soon? Things which must soon take place. How soon is it talking about? Is soon 1,000 years from now, as soon, 100 years from now, 10 years from now, 5 years from now? How soon is it? Well, you don't have to know Greek. I'm going to put it up on the screen for you, just so you know a little bit of what it looks like. But I also want you to see the commonalities. That's why I'm putting it up on the screen. So here's the Greek phrase here in Revelation 1. Ha de genestai en take. This word here is which, the things which must come into being, and it's talking about soon or when swiftly. It'll come into being soon. Now, where are those things? What are those things? Well, it's interesting. If you compare the Revelation chapter 1:1 to the Old Testament in Greek, I know it was written in Hebrew, Aramaic, there's some Persian language, there's all kinds of languages there. But there was an Old Testament version that you can do comparisons between the New and the Old Testaments. And it says this in Daniel chapter 2, which must come to pass in or during the last days. So it has that same phrase right there, doesn't it? You notice that? Am I the only one that can see that? It has the same phrase there. And those things over here, which must soon take place, we're talking about in the last days, them taking place back in Daniel. Daniel will give you a clue now to unlock what these things are, how soon they're going to take place, what it has to do with your life. If you go also to chapter 2, verse 45, it talks about this king, here's the word there, who basically was going to be shown what was going to take place in the last days. Same phrase here. So we're putting this all together, what things must soon take place, how do they affect our lives, becomes clear as we compare Scripture with Scripture. So Revelation is literally pointing us back to Daniel chapter 2, which is literally pointing us back to a dream that an ancient king had for us, really. It was not just for himself, it was also for us. So the things which must soon take place, what seems clear as I compare those scriptures, and maybe that method's too simple. Maybe comparing Scripture with Scripture is too simple. I don't know. I think that that's consistent. I think we can find and glean from all over the Bible and put it together, and we can have a clearer picture. That's the method that I use. But these things pertain to the end of the world, because that king was told what will happen in the last days. So we know that. We also know that this phrase has its roots in the Hebrew Scriptures, the book of Daniel. I just showed you the correlation between those right there on the screen. Revelation also refers or alludes to the Old Testament at least 489 times. You say, how come you, where'd you get that number? I went through every chapter and I counted every phrase, every place name, anything I could find that was very clearly in the Old Testament. Now, I might have missed a few. Some people say there's 600 occurrences where Revelation points you back, but I want to be conservative. 489 times, and I have all the sticky notes still in my Bible, and you will find then, if you're going to understand Revelation, what do you have to understand? The Old Testament. And yet, the Old Testament is oftentimes, from pulpits, one of the least studied, least proclaimed books, parts of the Bible that we have, right? So we need to have some of that understanding, some of that background. Otherwise, we're not even going to understand this very first verse of Revelation. And we haven't even gotten past verse 1. So these things which soon take place are somewhere in the Old Testament. We know that because Revelation points us over and over again. In fact, if you were to divide that up through the 22 chapters, you'd be looking at almost 20 occurrences, right, in every chapter. Some chapters more, some less. So the things are a series of events then. And according to Daniel chapter 2, the vision which we're going to look at just in a moment here, it's involving things that lead up to a coming king. That's the foundation for Revelation chapter 1. So in Revelation, what's interesting though, is that phrase right here, things that would come, take place quickly or soon, it happens down in chapter 22 as well. If you compare chapter 1 of Revelation with chapter 22, it's like you have these bookends telling you these things which must soon take place that are coming soon. And then at the end, Jesus the King says, I am coming soon. Now you know why the sermon is titled Coming Soon. This then, this whole prophecy has to then point us to this person coming. So let's take a look at it in Daniel chapter 1. I'm going to do a summary. If you have a Bible, you can turn there. Otherwise, I'm going to put the scriptures up on the screen. And I believe there in your handout, there or the main thoughts from most of these slides are right there, and most of the scriptures are right there. I'm on page 1 going into page 2 on your handout. So the Hebrews, by the time we get to Daniel chapter 1 in the Old Testament, the Hebrews have been brought into captivity. They've been marched across arid and semi-arid territory. Some think around over 1,000 miles trek. Some think more than that. They faced many trials for their faith to continue believing in the God of Israel. They've stood for what they believed in Daniel chapter 1. They wouldn't go along with the king's ways and his food and all of that. And we can't say that they had a pleasant experience at first, but eventually it developed to the place where it became more pleasant. But God also, because of their deciding to follow him, gave them different abilities. Particularly Daniel had the ability to understand dreams, we find out, and they all had wisdom. So go to Daniel 2:1. It says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. Notice it's plural. And his sleep was troubled, and his sleep went from him. This continues to compound in his mind. It's not just one-time incident. It keeps happening. This means, in his mind, something cataclysmic, something monumental, something amazing is going to happen. I better pay attention to this dream. Then the king commanded to call the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. The king said to them, I have dreamed a dream. My spirit is troubled to know the dream. Well, no wonder. He keeps having this dream. And now he wants to know what it means. And so the dream, in his mind, means some kind of message from the heavens, from the gods in his mind, particularly Marduk, his god. Somehow he thinks that heaven is communicating with him. He calls his wise men, who are supposed to be experts in that. He wants to make sure that they are telling him the truth. So he says, you tell me the dream. Not just pulling out your different books and things like that and saying, well, you tell us the dream and we'll tell you the interpretation. No, you tell me the dream that proves that you know the interpretation. Then they spake the Chaldeans, or his wise men, to the king in the Syrian language, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants to dream, and we will show the interpretation. Didn't he already tell them to give him the dream? Now, back then, you just didn't cross kings like that. I guess that's the easy way of saying it. You just didn't do that. If the king told you to do something, you do it. And they now are coming because they're afraid because they don't know what his dream is. Back and forth they seem to go. The wise men want to know the dream. The king wants them to tell him the dream. On it goes like this. And finally the king says, basically, you tell me the dream or you're dead. Is that too much of a summary? Well, that's kind of how it goes. Tell me the dream. I will know that you can interpret it. They said, there's not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. And now they're telling the truth, aren't they? Now, they kind of knew that because they saw the dreams were coming from the gods or from heavens. So they knew that they didn't have that information. But now they're really telling the truth because who gave this dream anyway? Well, we'll find out. Captain of the guard goes out to gather all the wise men, including Daniel and his friends who are wise men in training. Some of you are familiar with this story. Daniel and them request time to pray. And as they pray, Daniel is given the exact dream that the king was given. So who gave Daniel the dream? The God of heaven. So who gave King Nebuchadnezzar the dream? The God of heaven. It wasn't Marduk, wasn't the gods, it was the God of heaven. So Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. I remember back in 2012, and actually before that as well, when that whole Mayan prophecy was going on. Do you guys remember that? And we're trying to figure out with our wisdom and with our understanding, with all of our, is the world going to end, right? Well, this says, oftentimes we have our own opinions. Oftentimes we have our own understanding. But there is a God who has ultimate wisdom. There is a God that no matter what the world seems to be going towards, he has a plan. He has his power. He has his ways. And he's going to make things happen in a very hopeful way. He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings. He sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to them that have understanding. Even our own understanding is given by him. So Daniel was very clear here. It wasn't even from me. Don't honor me. This is the God of heaven who gave this to us. Arioch brought Daniel in before the king, said, I have found a man of the children of the captivity of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. And Daniel answered before the king and said, the secret which the king hath demanded can neither wise men, enchanters, magicians, nor soothsayers show unto the king, But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets. And he hath made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. That's that phrase that we find down in Revelation and other things referring us back to here. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. And you might have seen this vision before. Maybe you've seen pictures like this on the internet, or maybe you've been to a seminar like this before. This is what it looked something like this. You, O king, were watching, and behold, the great image, this great image whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. Image head was of fine gold, chest, arms of silver, belly, thighs of bronze, legs of iron, feet, partly iron, partly clay. That's an interesting dream, isn't it? You watched then while stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on the feet of iron and clay, broke them to pieces. This whole thing shatters and is broken and becomes like this chaff on the summer threshing floor. It starts to kind of get carried by the wind, and the wind carries it away, and there's no trace left. So this image just shatters, and the wind blows all of its pieces away. Now, what would you think if you had a dream like that? I know, we could come up with all kinds of interpretations, couldn't we? We could all come up with ideas of what it represents and what those feet were, what that rock was, and everything else. And it says that stone then struck the image. It became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now, what would you do with that one? That's an amazing image, isn't it? This rock comes, strikes the image of those multi-metal image. And then, and not only that, it shatters it, the wind carries the pieces away, and then that rock becomes this huge mountain and fills the whole world. Wow. I remember I was conducting a seminar in another part of the country, and somebody said, well, that's like the Twin Towers. I said, no, let's let the Bible give us this interpretation, because if you and I had that dream, we could come up with all kinds of interpretations on our own, couldn't we? In fact, somebody might just say, well, that was just a bad nightmare. I don't want to have that one again. If it doesn't come back again, it's not meant for me, right? It's for somebody else. But Nebuchadnezzar truly took it seriously. He believed it was a sign from the gods that had something to do with the future, and Daniel said it had to do with the latter days, the last days. And so that stone, what does it mean? If we let the Bible interpret itself, we come up with an answer, not just for the stone, but also for this. So in case you're wondering, you go on to Daniel chapter 2, you're given the interpretation. You don't have to guess. I don't have to guess. It's right here. You, O king, are king of kings. You are this head of gold. You and your glorious kingdom of Babylon, you are this head of gold. And we know from history they reigned from about 605 to 539 BC, and you can see on the maps, kind of general maps of their kingdoms. They were city kings, and eventually they developed bigger areas of vassal states and tribute cities. So this is the area there, and not only that, artists have had all kinds of renditions of this. In fact, if you were to go to some museums, you could see replicas or actually pieces of the Ishtar Gate. So there's that. You have the gardens there. Here's the Temple of Marduk way back over here. And what's flowing through here? Euphrates River. So this is going on, and this is the city of Babylon. A lot of commerce is taking place there. The city became strong enough to go out and conquer others around them, becomes basically a area power. Here's another close-up of the temple. Notice it's got that blue tile as well. The Hanging Gardens, people called them one of the wonders of the world. You want to go to some place and see something amazing, you're going to go to Babylon and see the Hanging Gardens, right? Not only that, it was also referenced that the king had a miniature zoo for his wife. One of his wives was from out of the area. He brought in animals and stuff from that area, had like a miniature zoo for her. And the size of it, if you compare the size of Babylon, 10 miles around compared to Rome and to Athens, it was bigger than those cities, actually those two combined. Temple of Marduk, which is that right there, 300 feet high. Outside, you have that blue glazed tile. Inside, overlaid with gold. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine these walls being overlaid with gold? What would that look like? Especially if you had entry for the sun to shine in and to hit and to light that whole inside up. What would that be, right? Speaking of gold, the temple had 18 tons of gold, 8.5 tons just in the altar where Marduk was. I mean, that's a lot of gold, isn't it? Of course, it took a lot of time to accumulate some of that over years, you know, all these different things that took place. They had, speaking of years, a 20-year food supply. Some people estimate maybe more, maybe less of that, but nonetheless, years of it. And Nebuchadnezzar was recorded as saying, "May it last forever." Good reason, right? Look at his city. It's amazing. Look at his conquest. It's extensive, at least for a city-state. And he thought it would last forever. And there, of course, is our boats and stuff going through the Euphrates River. But my question is, as I look at all of these artist renditions and all these different ideas, would it last forever? Because the image clearly says what? No, it's not going to last forever. So that's basically his own wish. Jeremiah prophesied this: Babylon will be a heap of ruins, a haunt of jackals, an object of horror and scorn, a place where no one lives. This is an archaeological dig, a picture of it. It's in the area of Babylon, and there's no one living there other than some archaeologists who visit from time to time. No permanent residence, anyway, though Saddam Hussein was trying to make it such. So Babylon shall sink and not rise from the catastrophe that I will bring upon her. Babylon would be great, but eventually Babylon would overstep its bounds and begin actually being abusive and misusing the right of kingship that God gave it. And so after you will rise another kingdom. What is the next kingdom then? If this is Babylon, what do you think that is? Some of you might know the answer. Actually, it's in your notes right there. You can easily find it there. It's Medo-Persia. But the Bible itself tells us that answer. So I'm not just following the history books, following Daniel chapter 5. In that night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. That's king of Babylon. Actually, he was a co-regent at the time. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So this 62-year-old general of Cyrus the Great comes in and basically establishes the kingdom of Cyrus over Babylon. There's all books written about Cyrus the Great. You can find those. First time I researched this was at the Umpqua Community College Library and found a whole book on Cyrus and how there was prophesied that he would become a great king. In fact, some people wanted to kill him at his birth because of the prophecies about him. And so Cyrus comes along and he succeeds where others have failed. It's not that others had not tried to attack Babylon and not tried to succeed. There's even a record, historical record, of a female general of another city kingdom that tried, but she dug out a little lake area and diverted the waters of the Euphrates, but she failed in her attempt. Well, Cyrus didn't fail in his attempt. He ends up draining the Euphrates River. It happens that the Nabonidus Chronicles records, there's an archaeological record, that they were celebrating the reentrance of the moon goddess. They had focused just on Marduk, but they had reintroduced the moon goddess and had this huge celebration. And because of that, they were in a drunken stupor. And Nabonidus, the main king, if you ever read Daniel, you wonder why Daniel was going to be the third ruler. Well, because Belshazzar, the last king in chapter 5, he had a dad who was actually somewhere else at the time when Babylon was taken over. And Nabonidus was his name. And Belshazzar, that night, was in charge. And, of course, he failed. Everyone was in a drunken stupor, and the city gates were left open. So you can imagine, you'd think that if you're really smart and someone had actually tried to invade you before, why would you then not think they would do it again by draining the Euphrates? Well, they did, but they were drunk, and they were in this whole party mode. And, of course, then Cyrus goes right in, virtually unopposed, some little resistance, and takes the city. You can read about this. As far as transcriptions from the Cyrus Cylinder, you can find that on the internet and read about how things took place. You can read about how people in the city, some were actually looking forward to freedom from Babylon, from King Nebuchadnezzar's family line, Belshazzar and them, and they laid down palm branches when Cyrus actually came into the city. So the Cyrus Cylinder records some of that. What's also interesting is Medo-Persia, these arms and chests of silver, had a tribute system, and when they inflicted a tribute system on a kingdom, they had them pay in silver, unless they were really wealthy, like India. And India would pay in gold, but their currency was primarily silver when it came to tribute. And so now we're down to the bellies and thighs of bronze. In Daniel 8, we have this description, and it's there in your notes. And as you look down there in Daniel chapter 8, the Bible tells you about a ram. This is over on page number 3. The ram which thou sawest that had the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough he-goat is the king of Greece. So notice, Medo-Persia, there they are. They're mentioned in chapter 8 of Daniel. No wonder. I mean, basically, Babylon is going downhill. Medo-Persia is taking over. Now these people are mentioned. But now in chapter 8, it mentions that a fight takes place. And if you've ever had animals, especially sheep or goats, you know what that looks like when they're slamming heads together, right? So I've had some sheep wrestle my ram to the ground with my bare hands one time. Well, three times, actually. A third time, he went to the butcher. But this is taking place, a he-goat and a ram, and wham, they collide. And unfortunately, this ram, or I guess I should say fortunately, because they were getting to the point where, as a kingdom, they were overstepping their bounds as well. With the two horns, he gets whooped on by the he-goat, and the he-goat comes in and takes over. And notice it says, the great horn that is between his eyes, this is Greece, is the first king. And anybody who knows history knows that's talking about Alexander the Great. And not only that, his companion cavalry was in the phalanx formation, all of that historical stuff, right? That's really a machine of war that the world had not quite seen yet, and he wielded that and took over huge portions of that part of the world. So it's not really that complicated when we think about it, and it makes sense because now the first king is there, and that's representing Alexander the Great. Psamtikus I of Egypt saw in invading Greek pirates the fulfillment of an oracle outside of the Bible that said men of bronze would come from the sea and basically inflict casualties and begin conquering. And where did they come from? Well, we know where they came from, don't we? They spread out from Greece and began to spread around the world in the Mediterranean. They took over, they conquered almost, and you can read about Alexander the Great and his tragedies, but his conquests all the way over towards Asia. And that's what we see. So now we are getting down to the thighs of bronze, and it seems like it's following history pretty well, isn't it? But then what about the fourth kingdom? In chapter 2, verse 40, the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdueth all things, as iron that crushes all these shall it break in pieces and crush. So if we go back, and we notice the kingdoms are getting bigger and bigger, aren't they? So what kingdom could literally take over this whole area from Greece? If you know Greco-Roman history, you know exactly what the answer is. Greco-Roman history. The Romans come next, don't they? And not only that, we find historians who talk about this. This is ever given. The images of gold, silver, brass that might serve to represent the nations and their kings were broken by Rome. If you want more of a general source on the internet, you can go to Wikipedia. You look up the Roman kingdom, look up the Iron Age, you'll start finding that they are the major player right after Greece. So from the bronze to basically the iron period. So Rome comes along, and we find that they then extend it tremendously, don't they? Over to modern Europe, all the way up to London as well. There's a whole set of stories about how they conquered that area. I won't get into all of them. But nonetheless, they expanded their kingdom and ruled. And it's no wonder that we have these stories in the Bible then, in Luke and other places, where it mentions they are the ones in power when Jesus is born. They're the ones in power when not only he's born, but he has to flee to Egypt because there's an attempt on his life. And not only is it mentioned at his birth that Rome's in power, all the way up to his baptism, all the way up to his death, it's all there about this iron monarchy of Rome. And so Rome comes along and rules this whole area. Of course, some of you might know that that's not where it ends, or we wouldn't be here today. We'd still have the Roman Empire, wouldn't we? Lots of attempts to try to reproduce that type of system, but it hasn't quite stuck. And that's why it says this, "And whereas thou saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay, part of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom." So Rome would be divided. "But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron." So there's still some of that. "For as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay." And so Rome begins to be divided, it says. We know from history there's different names for different nations, and really scholars can kind of debate that if they want. But the main point is that Europe becomes a divided nation. Actually, it's still divided to this day. We have different alliances and things to try to keep some semblance of unity. But Europe becomes the central point there. They kind of erode away at the Roman Empire. In fact, a lot of trouble happened up in this region here, over into the Germanic peoples. And so if we were to follow and put it into kind kind of an outline, it would look something like this, wouldn't it? So we're going from there to there to there to there to there, and now we're down into here. We're down in here into the feet of iron and clay, and we would expect what? What's going to come and crash there? A rock, right? Now, why is this important for Revelation? The things which must soon take place lead up to the end of the world and the coming king. So if you have this in mind and you're reading Revelation, it's one of the indicators to help you understand Revelation. You're going to see things that parallel this in Revelation. You're going to see that really we go from, by the time John writes, we're down here at the time of the iron legs, right? But he's writing about things from his time all the way down past his time, all the way down to the coming of another kingdom. So this helps you understand where you're at in Earth's history, but especially that after John's time, there will come other events, other things that will soon take place. They will mingle with the seed of men. We saw this happen. This is happening down here. And after John's time, Rome is divided after John's time, sometime later. And as a result, people kept trying to unite it back together. You can see that in Daniel chapter 2. Even through marriage, they're trying to do this. You know, different pictures we can throw up here on the screen about this, of the family lines and genealogies of Europe. If you've ever been on Ancestry.com looking up your ancestry, you start tracing it back, and some way, way back there is this somebody who's related to somebody who's related to somebody related to them, right? Someone there, if you're European heritage anyway. And they united themselves through marriage, through warfare, and politics. And you can see all kinds of pictures of this. And even Napoleon, we think Napoleon was mostly a conqueror, but he also united in marriage with others as well. But the Bible says they would not mingle. That would not successfully unite them to the point where the coming kingdom would not take over this world. So the Bible is still being fulfilled to this day, isn't it? So if we're living during this time here, and now we're living not just in around 476 after Rome is being divided, but now we're down here in the present, aren't we? Aren't there still attempts to unite Europe? Even like right now, there are attempts to unite Europe, aren't there? And I'm not saying there shouldn't be some unity against oppression and other things, but notice the emphasis on bringing people. Notice how fast things have happened with Finland and others. So the things which must soon take place then are taking place right now. All this has already taken place. It's like the world has followed the Bible like a blueprint. And now we're down here, and the things which must soon take place don't pertain to here, because we're already watching this. This is in our time and beyond, right? It's our time, present time right now. This is really where the vision goes. You watched while the stone was cut out without hands. And this stone is being described in the book of Daniel. And in fact, I believe it's down on page 3, halfway down. You watched while the stone was cut out, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, broke them into pieces. So this, all of the kingdoms of the world, all their glory, things that were left over from Rome are now still around, right? That's going to end. It's going to come to an end. And so let's go back to Revelation 1, where it says, these things which must soon take place. We know have to do with the end of the world. Are we living at the end of the world then? Since we're right down there, and really the next main event is that rock? We know it has its roots in the Hebrew Scriptures. Did we just see all of that in the Hebrew Scriptures? We see in Daniel especially parallels to this. It involves a series of events or things taking place, but according to Daniel 2, the main focus of the vision is a coming king. Not to this world. It says it outside of this world comes from heaven. And in Revelation, that's why in chapter 22, it says, write these things, and Jesus says, yes, I come quickly. Those things which must soon take place are having to do with this king in Revelation. And I believe, since history has followed the Bible, this king will come. Not maybe, not if, it's a matter of when. That's what it's a matter of. So Daniel 2:44 said, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never, never be destroyed. Do you notice where that rock is coming from, though? Is it just here in this world? Setting up a mountain that grows out of the world, right? No, it's coming from heaven. Remember that. Because there are lots of interpretations of Revelation in the Bible that focus on the here and now, and somehow we have to kind of make everything perfect, a utopia, and then this will take place. But Daniel points out that when this kingdom comes, he obliterates all those other kingdoms, and his kingdom will never be destroyed. It will break into pieces and consume all these kingdoms. Our kingdoms are not going to usher in this kingdom. There's only one thing that's going to usher in this kingdom. Jesus' own words in Matthew 24, he said, "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached into all the nations, and then the end will come." It has nothing to do with this world. As far as a revival in this world, yeah, maybe we could see that. Maybe we could focus on that. But as far as the kingdoms of this world, using that political power to usher in a heavenly kingdom, that is not what this is talking about. In fact, any attempt to do that will be a fulfillment of Daniel 2, where they will not cleave one to another. And so, that's why I titled this coming soon, "The things which must soon take place pertain to this event," that a coming kingdom is taking place. And now as we read through the rest of Revelation, we keep this image in the back of our minds, because what happens is we'll see interesting parallels from the time of John to that image, especially the last part, legs of iron, all the way down to the second coming. We'll see parallels in the seven churches. We'll see parallels in the seven trumpets and the seven seals. We'll start seeing parallels that will fill in the blanks as to what happened from the time of John all the way down to this event. And so stay tuned for that. But my question is, as I read Revelation, it describes two kingdoms. It describes two people. It says in Revelation 21, there's a city whose builder and maker is God that comes down out of heaven. It's called this New Jerusalem. It's a place where there's no more crying, no more pain, no more sorrow. And then there's this other city, Babylon. Interesting, isn't it? That imagery comes back into Revelation, and we see it repeatedly in Revelation. And the question that Revelation has for us, are we just going to be focused on the here and now, or are we going to focus on the coming kingdom? Are we going to be in that city that he's prepared for us, or are we going to be in Revelation 19, the other city that represents this world? I don't know about you, but as I look at pictures like this, as I read the scriptures, I think of what is it going to be like on that day when it describes that there's a city who has light within itself, that there is no more night, that there is no more hardship, that there are no more tears. That song about blessings, that will be over with. There will be no more struggles and sorrows. Which city would you like to be in? I think it's pretty obvious the reason why you're here is to learn more about God and his place. And so I pray that that's the case. I invited Janet to lead us in a song to have us just kind of imagine a place where there's no more night, a place where there's no more suffering, no more sickness. And it's not just to make us feel good. It's actually going to happen. This prophecy predicted it. We're experiencing it. It is coming soon.
It's not a dream.
I don't know about you, but I want to be in that place, don't you? Father in heaven, thank you so much for this reminder tonight. Things are coming soon, but those things pertain to you. And you've told us this ahead of time so that we don't have to be hopeless. We don't have to keep watching the news and wondering, is this the way it's all going to end? We know that there's a hopeful future for each one of us, a place with no more night, a place with no more sickness or sorrow. Guide us to trust you. In the midst of everything we see going on around us, help us to keep remembering that this world is not the end, that Jesus, you are coming soon, and we can trust you as our coming King. We pray in your name. Amen. I invite you to open up your binders there and take a look at the schedule so you can kind of see where we're headed.